I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door. And we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
Not a word. You're tuned to the Labor Hour. I'm Pat Simpson, the latest addition to the program, and I want to wish everybody a happy St. Patrick's Day. Especially my greetings go out to David Johnson, one of the usual co-hosts here who cannot be here because he's at a Jobs with Justice meeting. And normally I would be at a Jobs with Justice meeting too, but because of a commitment to do a special program today on women's labor history, I am here instead of at the meeting. I think it's particularly important to wish a happy St. Patrick's to David Johnson because normally he does a particular show on Irish workers around this time of year. And on top of it, today really is St. Patrick's Day. But we will certainly discover that when you look at women's labor history, you're going to see the Irish playing a role. I'm here with my co-host today, Bob Polesny, who is not only a co-host, but perhaps one of the most superior technical advisors that we have around this radio station, and Bill Gorell, who's one of the original founders of the program and continues to offer some really interesting insights into labor issues and sometimes even other kinds of issues. And that being said, I think it's time that we talk about the underwriters of this program. So, Bob, would you take it away?
Sure. Thanks, Pat. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. Isn't that like today, the third Saturday?
Exactly.
Yeah. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, you can call them at 217-469-6111. And also, this hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide, recognizing that strong workers build strong communities. The AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Pat?
Thanks, Bob. I think it's time that we also turn to talking about some of the latest issues in the news pertaining to labor. And Bob, do you have anything for us on that?
I'll find a couple stories here pretty quick. I did want to mention quickly that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers had nearly 1,000 Fair Food activists flocked to Lakeland, Florida last Saturday to show their support for the 61 workers and allies who'd fasted for 6 days to demand that the grocery store chain, Publix, do its part to support the Coalition for Immokalee Workers Fair Food Program. A week later, the support is still coming in. They're getting support from various people, a group of MBA evening program classes at Georgetown University lent their support. Also, a lot of clergy throughout Florida lend their support to the issue. They had their fast ended. 61 people were fasting for 6 days, and their fast ended last Saturday. I got a story also out of Thailand and Burma. There's six top garment makers are fleeing to low-wage Burma. There's a current labor shortage in Thailand, and the plan to raise minimum wage next month has encouraged the country's 15 largest garment manufacturers to relocate to neighboring countries. During the past year, Thai garment producers have invested a combined $200 million to set up new plants in other Asian countries, including Cambodia, Vietnam, and Laos. More than 10 local apparel producers would set up new plants in Burma in the second half of this year, after Burma has made moves toward democracy and a little bit of flexibility in its investment laws. Initial investment capital for starting each new plan is expected to average about $10 million U.S. dollars for a total of $60 million, and they're going to do this in Rangoon. That's the first place that the Thai investors are looking to explore, since it's a little more highly developed infrastructure and it has a port there. It's planned that each plant would employ as many as 1,000 to 3,000 laborers. The Burmese government is planning soon to amend its investment law, which has been unchanged for 24 years, and Burma's labor costs are one-third lower than those in Thailand. And also out of Toronto, Rio Tinto has locked out 780 members of the United Steelworkers at its smelter in Alma, Quebec. They locked them out back on December 31st, 2011. Because of growing interest and involvement by working people internationally, steelworkers in Alma, Quebec have launched an English version of their website today. They previously had had a French language site, but they've launched a English site now, www.justiceforriotintoworkers.ca. And let's see, they're organizing a massive rally in Alma, Quebec, coming up Saturday, March 31st, and they're looking for members of the community and supporters from far and wide to join them in their fight against Rio Tinto and call for a fair deal with quality jobs for future generations, and they'll call for an end to Rio Tinto's war on workers. And once again, Rio Tinto locked out those workers back on December 31st, 2011.
So. Is it just me, or has historically the mining industry just been incredibly egregious when it comes to labor issues?
Incredibly egregious over the years. I mean, you go back to, you know, what you talk about many times in West Virginia and some of the Harlan, Kentucky stuff. It's just amazing.
Yeah, we'll be talking about Mother Jones a little later today, and certainly her life shows the many terrible conditions in various kinds of mines. It wasn't just coal. Of course, as the United Mine Workers began to spread their protective influence, a protective umbrella, some of those conditions got cleaned up in the United States. But the problem is we're seeing the rise of non-union mines again. And a lot of those mines where you've seen accidents recently and people losing their lives, those are non-union mines.
And some of the mines in other countries are far, far worse than the mines in this country.
Oh, yes.
You read about some of the mines in South America, Peru and stuff, some of the conditions. People are climbing through tunnels that are 2 foot high and stuff like that. They're crawling on their bellies to get there, and they work for ungodly hours. It's just amazing.
Crawling on your bellies, typically under old conditions, you'd also be basically up to your knees sometimes in water. And another country that has a really terrible record on this is China. I mean, virtually every year, or several times a year, seeing Chinese miners die in terrible working conditions, because of terrible working conditions. The other thing I wanted to comment on is that story about Burma, and essentially what you got there is a perfect example of one of the problems of globalization for labor, because one country begins to improve its labor standards, sometimes because of pressure from international agencies as well as labor rights advocates, and then what happens is the companies simply move elsewhere. And also what's interesting is Burma may be loosening up, becoming a bit more democratic. We'll see what the final outcome of that really is. But so often the most abusive labor conditions are very much linked to anti-democratic governmental forms, and certainly the shift to Burma is an interesting one in that regard. Anything else, Bob?
Yes. No, I think that wraps up my news stories for this week. I had some other things. I could talk a little bit more about domestic workers and stuff. We mentioned that.
I would really like to hear about domestic workers again. This is a program where we're going to be focusing on the history of women in labor, so I think any issue that's of particular importance for them is something we need to talk about.
I got a story here that came out of Labor Notes, basically, and it says for 76 years, domestic workers have been excluded from federal labor law, from overtime and safety and health protections, in addition to collective bargaining rights. and the exclusion was no accident. When Congress debated the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, Southern representatives insisted that two groups who were then a majority African American be left out, farm workers and domestic workers. In the last 2 years, however, initiatives for domestic workers' rights have scored important victories. Activists in New York State won passage of a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, and since November of 2010, domestic workers received time and a half after 40 hours per week and 44 hours per week for living workers, and they're entitled to a day of rest every 7 days, 3 paid days of rest per year, and protection under the state's human rights legislation. The U.S. Department of Labor in December announced plans to extend the minimum wage and time and a half for overtime to 2 million home health aides and personal assistants. And last June, an international coalition of unions, human rights organizations, and domestic worker organizations successfully lobbied the International Labor Organization of the United Nations to adopt a new convention. If ratified by member countries, international law would guarantee domestic workers' rights to freely associate, collectively bargain, and be free from discrimination over citizenship status. And the National Domestic Workers Alliance, that's a coalition of more than 70 programs, is working for a Bill of Rights in California that's modeled after the New York version, and that would protect more than 200,000 child care workers, housekeepers, and caregivers, and they're anticipating a similar push in Massachusetts as well.
Yeah, and actually I've heard through the Interfaith Worker Justice Group that there is efforts at, even at the national level to provide some kind of protective labor laws for domestic servants. And I think that this is, again, a very important area, an area that's been neglected in terms of protections for labor laws over basically the whole of the United States history. And it would be really important if we did something about providing protection for these workers. Speaking of the effort to pass protective laws for domestic workers, this also reminds me of some programs we're going to have coming up. We don't have exact dates yet, but at some point in April, we're going to be having Kim Bobo, who is the executive director of the Interfaith Center for Worker Justice, coming on the air and discussing with us some of these kinds of issues, because the Interfaith Committee has been working on these issues, but also other areas that they are particularly pushing these days. Of course, they're particularly interested in helping out low-wage workers and bringing, as the term interfaith suggests, various members of the various religious faiths together to work on behalf of low-income workers. So that's going to be coming up. Then in April, which again is Environmental Month, we're expecting to have a phone interview with the executive director of the David Foster of the Blue Green Alliance, which is a group that has a coalition group that's been started by the Sierra Club as well as the Steelworkers. Steelworkers have been very progressive on this issue in recent years, as well as other unions and environmental groups that have now joined. And he's going to be talking about what's going on with the Blue Green Alliance. So keep tuned. We will give you more information on exact dates for those interviews as they come up.
I saw something this week that the Blue Green Alliance had a green jobs conference in Atlanta or something.
Had a conference. They usually have an annual conference. I've never been able to attend, although I certainly am a person who is very interested in seeing those coalitions coming together and working jointly on a green jobs policy and program in this country at this point. I also thought that I would mention something that isn't directly a labor issue, but I don't know if folks, it certainly is a class issue. I don't know if folks were tuned in this week when there was all the hoopla over the epic resignation letter by Wall Street investment banker who worked for Goldman Sachs when he talked about what really is going on at Goldman Sachs. And, of course, we can't presume that this is something that you're going to be, that is endemic to.
And all the comments are, it took 12 years to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, of course, I actually was listening to a program this morning where there are some jokes about, oh, is it surprising that they're concerned about the bottom line? But the issue goes above and beyond the normal pursuit of the bottom line, which, of course, you expect any of these companies to be emphasizing.
That they call their customers Muppets?
Yeah, I was thinking that we could have a new slogan, Muppets of the World Unite. You have nothing to overthrow except for your strange designation as a Muppet. But it is also the case that what he really seemed to be saying is that there's a lot of illegal practices or near illegal practices that are going on to basically shake down the common investor. And
you are supposed to be their, not really their customers, but their clients.
Oh, yes, right.
You know, I don't know the exact definition, how those two terms relate, but it seems to me like a client is somebody who, you know, gets... more, you know, like lawyers have clients, they don't have customers.
Right.
You know, you have some fiduciary ethical responsibility to a client, I would think.
Yeah, well, supposedly they do. I think that's built into their ethical codes within
the
industry. And
for their long-term good, it counts. And see, that's, you know, we always hear this about regulation, and pro-business people always quite often act real anti-regulation. Well, they just don't like the regulations that get in their particular way.
Right.
Generally, industries as wholes have promoted regulation. For example, 100 years ago, food, you know, meat. I mean, hamburger, well, it's become suspect again because of the new pink slime issue that's come
up. Exactly.
But the food industry needed regulation to get people to buy their stuff at the stores because people were afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
To say, I mean, it's similar, and also too, regulations do tend to raise barriers to entry for competitors. So a lot of times, a lot of this stuff about regulations and such is definitely real hypocritical.
Absolutely. And also, I think another thing that this points out, there are many who would argue against any kind of tax increases for the wealthy that would argue along the lines of, but they earned it. Well, I think when you read stories like this, you come to understand that not all, of course, because if you look at the details on who comprises the 1%, for example, not everybody is a Wall Street employee. But in point of fact, a good number of them are. And there's some real question about really exactly how did they make their gains? How are they continuing to make their gains? And given these unethical practices, doesn't it make all the sense in the world that maybe redistribution makes a bit of sense just along these lines or just on this basis? So interesting story, the kind of thing that I'm sure maybe they'll be talking about more on Occupy the Air a little later today.
But I mean, that attitude, I mean, it's what led to the, you know, the economic breakdown suffered, you know, the Great Decession. And because it's just like no regard for their clients, even much less anyone else. And it's just that this type of attitude permeating, you know, the financial industry leads to these excesses, which could lead to the, I mean, look, you know, if people lose complete confidence in the finance system, what's that going to do for business?
Exactly. And also, I think I'd like to emphasize that when you look at words like Muppets, which is partly what this fellow who wrote this letter was trying to emphasize, what you're looking at is not just that, hey, you know, we're trying to take our clients, but this incredible level of contempt and a culture, and that's part of what he's arguing about. It's not just one bad apple. It is a culture of contempt. It is people who really do think they're masters of the universe. And therefore, being a master of the universe, their definition is they can take everybody else.
Yeah.
CEO say at one point he thought they were doing God's work or something to that effect?
Well, see, if people don't realize, and this might be, I don't know, I have this background studying communications and rhetoric and so on and so forth. And which were like Foucault had this idea called discursive formations, which is that you have this language system that you exist in, and you can only think about what you have words for, or what you can talk about, or what is allowed within that. And then Kenneth Burke also had this idea called terministic screens, where he's talking about how the way that your profession, the way you make your living, or I suppose, you know, in some instances, just the way you spend most of your time, whether it has to do with money or not, you know, develops like these sets of jargon that you use. And I just really feel like that these people are get so totally isolated from, I mean, I can understand the difference just because of the various different things that I've gone through in my life. I couldn't imagine being, you know, somebody that's handling billions of dollars and being in some big office in a skyscraper somewhere and, you know, having other people get my coffee and everything, you know, like that. I mean, they must have a totally different, I would think it would be such an abstracting view of everything.
I think it is. It's a cocoon. It's a real cocoon.
And it's suffering very little, if any, consequences.
Absolutely.
Oh, you know, if you want to take a break, I did hand you that one CD, and it has some Irish content.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to do, given that I've got some other things that I committed to play, if we need to play it a little later on today, let's do that, because we do want to recognize the Irish. Especially, we may have a little more time to, if you will, fill in, because our working class poet, Tom Thomas, has taken the day off, and so we have a little more time than we normally do. So if you hold it on to that, Bill, we'll play it maybe just a little bit later.
By the way, they are jokes at the expense of the Irish.
Oh, that's okay.
Mick and Pat. Well, you know,
why don't we play something right now? I got it queued up over there on CD1, and
right here.
Do y'all know why God invented whiskey? To make sure the Irish didn't take over. So this is a true Irish story. Pat and Mick are on the boat on their way over to the United States. And Pat says to Mick, "Well, Mick, have you got employment when you get to the United States?" "Oh, indeed I have," he says. "Me brother's got me a fine job in the building trades." "Oh, the building trades," says Pat. "Don't you know that's dirty, dangerous work? You'll be taking your life in your hands." Mick says to Pat, "Well, Mr. Fancy Pants, what sort of employment have you secured for yourself in the United States?" "Oh, it's all been explained to me," says Pat. "Me Uncle William tells me the streets in the United States is paved with gold. I intend to support myself by picking up the gold I find in the streets." "Oh, you're daft," says Mick. "You'll be carrying a hod like me soon enough. But don't you know they go through customs at Ellis Island? Their first day on American soil, they set foot on Manhattan Island, and there right in front of them on the street is a $20 gold piece." Pat elbows Mick. "There now, don't you see me uncle was right? The streets is paved with gold, just like he said." And he saunters right on past the coin. Mick says, "Well, aren't you going to pick it up, man?" He says, "You forget yourself. This is Sunday. I'll start work tomorrow." Well, as you might guess, he ended up carrying a hod sooner than later. And this is purportedly a true story. It's called The Sick Note. "Dear boss, I write this note to you to tell you of my plight. And at the time of writing, I am not a pretty sight. My body is all black and blue, my face a deathly gray. And I write this note to say why Paddy's not at work today. Whilst working on the 14th floor, some bricks I had to clear. To throw them down from such a height was not a good idea. But then my foreman came along the bloody awkward sod, and he said I'd have to cart them down the ladder in me hod. Well, clearing all those bricks by hand, it seemed so very slow, that I hoisted up a barrel and secured the rope below. But in my haste to do the job, I was too dense to see that a barrel full of building bricks was heavier than me. And so when I untied the rope, the barrel fell like lead, and clinging tightly to the rope, I started up instead. I shot up like a rocket when, to my dismay, I found that halfway up I met that bloody barrel coming down. The barrel broke my collarbone as to the ground it sped, and when I reached the top, I banged the pulley with my head. Still clinging tightly, numb with shock from this almighty blow, when the barrel spilled out half its bricks 14 floors below. Now when those bricks had fallen from the barrel to the floor, I then outweighed the barrel, so I started down once more. Still clinging tightly to the rope, my body racked with pain, and halfway down I met that bloody barrel once again. The force of this collision halfway up the office block caused multiple abrasions and a nasty state of shock. Still clinging tightly to the rope, I thundered toward the ground and landed on the broken bricks the barrel scattered round. I lay there bleeding on the bricks. I thought I'd passed the worst. Then the barrel hit the pulley wheel and then its bottom burst. A shower of bricks rained down on me. I hadn't got a hope. As I lay there groaning on the ground, I let go the bloody rope. The barrel then being heavier, it started down once more and landed right across me as I lay upon the floor. It broke 3 ribs in my left arm, and I can only say that I hope you'll understand why Paddy's not at work today.
That was Ann Feeney, and Bill has a little update on Ann.
Yeah, I got her on her email list, which is called the Fellow Traveler Advisory Report. And anyway, she said there that her most recent examination, there was no sign at all of any cancer anymore, which is very good news for Ann. And
very good news, yes. And
excellent.
As I have experience as a hod carrier, I do appreciate those two stories.
There you go.
Mike and Pat, the hod carriers.
Absolutely. And actually, for those who don't know, Ann Feeney is a wonderful musician and singer, songwriter, has done labor songs now since, at least the 60s, comes out of Pittsburgh, and occasionally comes through town. Hasn't been here for a while. But
I think the last time she was in town was when David Johnson brought her over to the IMC, the Independent Media Center there, and she played.
I think she was at Gregory Hall. After
was
that,
she at?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, with David Rovics one time?
Yeah, it was Dave Rovics. Yeah. That was, about 2 years ago, I think.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I think she's been a bit off the road fighting this cancer for some time, but we hope to see her around again.
I think she's proud to call herself a rabble-rouser, too.
Yeah, well, we like those women rabble-rousers, for sure. Yeah. I just want to remind everybody, this is WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, and all the opinions and views that you're hearing are ours and our guests and are not the views or opinions of WEFT.
Oh, yeah, and I also want to add to that, for those of you who don't know, hod carriers are laborers who help bricklayers. So that's what he was dealing with, the 50-gallon barrel
mainly
of bricks.
Yeah. Carry supplies and stuff. And
right. We would deliver the bricks and the blocks.
Mortar.
And we don't do this as much anymore, but build the scaffolds, because now they have these big motorized scaffolds that are just amazing.
Oh, yeah.
They raise themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful term that comes out of Ireland and Great Britain, et cetera. All right, well, this is Women's History Month, as we've mentioned, so we thought we would put together a segment on women's labor history for the show. Of course, women have been a part of labor history in the United States since its earliest decades. why even some of the first factories in the U.S. in the Industrial Revolution in Lowell, Massachusetts, depended on female labor, namely young single women from the nearby countryside. There was a demographic imbalance because of the American Revolution and the loss of many men's lives in that confrontation. And
this was mainly in the garment industry?
Well, it was in textiles, what we would consider textiles at that point.
Is there like a pattern with civilizations where, say, like you have agriculture, then there's textiles, and then maybe not civilizations, but with modern societies, economies, and then you develop your steel, and now the auto industry.
I think certainly that was the case in the Industrial Revolution, and in terms of the development patterns of all the what we think of as the Western European and the United States countries. But what you're seeing with development in some of the developing countries today, or those that have developed in, say, since World War II, is they skip over some of those stages and don't necessarily focus. For example, it is true that textiles have been very important in China, but China certainly moved into automobiles almost at the same time. So the pattern deviates a little bit. So we talked a little bit about women being present at the Industrial Revolution, an important element in the labor force, but I thought I'd move forward a bit to introduce you to one of the most legendary and colorful of late 19th and early 20th century labor leaders, namely Mother Jones, who was herself born in Cork, so she is definitely an Irish-American female labor leader. And Bob's going to play something for us that tells us a little bit about her with Utah Phillips, a great labor troubadour we lost about 6 years ago, and Annie DeFranco.
I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. Was a woman. It was a Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, well, the men had been organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the Hollis, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was a strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous.
Okay, that was a story by Utah and Annie DeFranco about Mother Jones. It did emphasize all the important points about her. One of the things I think that's really interesting about her is that she did not support the suffragette movement, which you could think of as kind of the feminist movement of that time. And her point was that you don't need votes to raise heck. So women could, she believed, raise heck without the vote. Interesting aspect about Mother Jones. Of course, there are always those labor leaders like Mother Jones who are going to remain well-known beyond their lifetimes. But then there are the countless working women who played essential parts in important and very dramatic events who remain nameless and faceless. Such are the innumerable rank-and-file women who joined the 1912 Lawrence textile strike. And by the way, we just celebrated the 100th anniversary of that strike, the ending of that strike just a few days ago. The next segment that we're going to do, it was done by a group of high school students and ends with a little bit of the famous song Bread and Roses, which we're going to talk about because the Lawrence 1912 strike was the Bread and Roses strike. But the little video that they offer, which we have the sound for, will give you some sense of what was happening in Lawrence in 1912. Bob?
There you go.
The Bread and Roses strike occurred in Lawrence, Massachusetts. It started on January 12, 1912, and lasted 9 weeks. Lawrence was a factory town, and factory towns were generally miserable places to live. The average mill worker lived 22 years less than the company owners did. The main mills in Lawrence belonged to the American Woolen Company, which was a conglomerate of 34 New England factories. The average worker got $8.76 a week. Most of the workers were poor immigrants that spoke a dozen different languages and came from a variety of religious and ethnic backgrounds. More than half of the workers were women and children. In Massachusetts, school was required for children under the age of 14, but many parents lied about their children's age so their children would be able to work.
What are you doing? You have to get to work!
I'm only 11.
Well, you're 14 now, so let's go!
Fine.
No, I'm not kidding. We don't have time. We need the money. Let's go. March.
A Massachusetts law passed the legislature reducing the maximum work week from 56 to 54 hours and took effect on January 1st,
1912. All right, guys, we got to do something about these labor conditions here in Massachusetts. What do you think we should do?
Shortening the work week.
Yes, good idea. All right, which
we okay, do? So it's 56 now. Yeah. We cut it by 54. I mean, they get 2 hours, right?
That's sweet. Good.
Awesome. We're done.
To make up for losing 2 hours of work each week, the mill owner sped up production and cut the workers' pay.
Just because the state gave you less hours doesn't mean we need less cloth. Let's go! Work faster!
Polish women weavers were the first to notice a decrease in pay. On January 11th, their paycheck was 32 cents short.
Yes! Paycheck!
This can't be right. I'm 32 cents short.
Yeah.
They cut our paycheck.
Oh, no, they did not. We're totally striking tomorrow.
These Polish women were the first to strike, and they walked through the streets of Lawrence shouting short pay. Soon, many more workers joined the cause. The American Federation of Labor was not interested in a strike that involved women and unskilled workers, so the Industrial Workers of the World stepped in. The IWW chose Joseph Eder to assist the strike.
So, why would you be perfect for this job?
Well, my name is Joseph Eder. I'm fluent in English, Italian, and Polish. And can understand Hungarian and Yiddish, which makes me the perfect person to handle the diverse strikers.
All right then, good job.
Under the leadership of Eder, the protesters organized the first mass picket in any New England town. The police sprayed the protesters with hoses, and they retaliated by throwing ice at the police. Money came in from all over the country to fund relief communities, which were a network of soup kitchens and food distribution stations set up by each nationality group. The Bread and Roses strike used new striking tactics. Large groups would go into stores and disrupt business by not buying anything. Huge marches were organized with strikers singing, chanting, and carrying banners. January 29th, a large march was led through the business district. That evening, Antelope Pizza was shot by police that were trying to break up a picket line. Then, martial law was enforced. City officials declared all public meetings illegal, and Lawrence authorities called out 22 more militia companies to patrol the streets. Strikers began to walk in picket lines wearing white armbands that said, "Don't be a scab." Women began carrying signs that said, "We want bread and roses too." Bread symbolized their basic needs in life, and roses symbolized the respect due to them as women. Many families tried to send their children to sympathetic families in other cities. Lawrence police then forbade people from leaving the city. On February 24th, a group of mothers accompanied their children to the railroad station. Police brutally clubbed women and children, threw them into patrol wagons, and 30 women were put in jail.
"Come on, son. We have to get you out of this horrid town, so let's go to the train station, okay?"
"Okay."
"No! No! Let me get my son out!"
Newspapers reported this horrendous scene, and people all over America were outraged.
"That's horrible!
Ugh. What? That can't be right. Have you seen this? That is not okay!"
President William Howard Taft ordered an investigation into the industrial conditions in Lawrence and throughout America.
"I, President Taft, have heard the allegations of police brutality and demand a congressional investigation into the working conditions in Lawrence and all around the country."
The investigation hearings caused so much negative publicity for the American Woolen Company that they decided to settle. On March 12, 1912, management agreed to a 15% pay raise, double pay for overtime, and amnesty for strikers.
The Bread and Roses strike is important because it gave power to women and immigrants and showed that they could win if they worked together.
The strike could have been prevented if the Massachusetts legislature had given more thought to what shortening workers' hours would do.
The Bread and Roses strike is similar to the Writers Guild of America strike of 2007 because both strikes were protesting low wages.
"As we come marching, marching in the beauty of the day."
What you just heard at the end was a little bit of Joan Baez's version of the song that has become associated with the strike, Bread and Roses, which many people regard as perhaps the loveliest of all labor songs. I thought it would be really nice and bring it up to the contemporary period, as well as add a little Celtic influence here, to have a version of Bread and Roses that was actually sung and specially dedicated to the Wisconsin teachers, of course, largely a female labor force, as they faced off with Dear Governor Walker last fall. So if we could play that version of Bread and Roses. that's Bread and Roses, and it is a song which, again, really emphasizes the idea that comes out of the original eight-hour day movement, which was, it's not just about money. It's also about we working people want to have the leisure time to be able to have access to the good things of life, culture, education, etc. And I just want to repeat a couple of lines because you may not have caught it. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. Bill, did you want to say something about that?
Well, yeah, our little discussion before the song of about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Joe Hill and the song Rebel Girl, I just found this. On November 29th, 1914, okay, he wrote to the editor of Solidarity, quote, "The female workers are sadly neglected in the United States, especially on the West Coast, and consequently we have created a kind of one-legged, freakish animal of a union, and our dances and blowouts are kind of stale and unnatural on account of being too much of a buck affair. They are lacking the life and inspiration which the women alone can produce." And anyway, it says here, soon afterward, Hill began corresponding with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, a prominent IWW organizer. A warm friendship developed through numerous letters and a visit she paid Hill in his jail cell. After having exchanged several letters with Miss Flynn, Hill wrote to his friend Sam Murray, "I have been busy working on a song named The Rebel Girl, which I hope will help line up the women in the OBU, one big union." Mm-hmm. 9 months later, as he faced execution, he wrote to her, quote, "You have been an inspiration, and when I composed The Rebel Girl, you was right there and helped me all the time. As you furnished the idea, I will, now that I am gone, give you all the credit for that song, and be sure to locate a few more rebel girls like yourself, because they are needed and needed badly." The Rebel Girl clearly shows Hill's idea of the importance of women to the rebel cause, and while it was inspired by Miss Flynn, it was dedicated to all the women of the IWW.
Yes, and we're going to talk a little bit in coming weeks about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in more detail, as well as play Hazel Dickens' version of The Rebel Girl. We'll have even a little interview that Flynn gave towards the end of her life. But Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was at the Lawrence strike as an organizer for the IWW. And I think on the note that Bill has brought up, the importance of being rebels, and women, we can be rebels too. This is WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign, and you've been listening to the Labor Hour. And in a moment, we'll probably be having the folks from Occupy the Air coming in to give us their wonderful version of events in the week and what's happening in terms of class. As we all know, class matters. We've certainly seen that happening in our little excerpt we had from the Goldman Sachs worker who just retired, resigned from that organization. And that being said, we'll see you next week.
Oh, Pat, are we still in the air?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to mention thank you, everybody, for turning out to the Flexengate Workers Speak Out last Saturday. It was a very, very well-attended event. It was standing room only. And then last Tuesday, the demonstration out in front of Flexengate on East University Avenue, Urbana, across from the FS Farm Store, was a great success, a huge turnout. And Flexengate had security people out there and everything else, but there was some excellent, excellent costumes and signs made by the Occupy Arts Underground for this event. So I just want to say that both events are very successful, and I really am hoping that we can make the April 19th Mitch Daniels talk over here to the Champaign County Republicans, basically the demonstration for that, an equal success. And Pat, excellent job on the show today. This is Pat's first hosting the Labor Hour, so I just want to say that you did an excellent job.
Well, thank you. And now we're going to hear a little bit more from Ann Feeney.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you in on a secret that every scoundrel knows. Whether he's perched on a pulpit or wrapped in a flag that glows, there ain't no savior to break bad behavior, no great judgment day in the sky. I've got the answer to corporate cancer, all truth-dodging dancers in high places without a soul. 'Cause I took a poll.